In October 1955, a small ship, the MV Joyita, departed Samoa bound for the Tokelau Islands, a journey of over 400 kilometres across the southern Pacific Ocean. However, the Joyita never reached its destination. Days later, it was found adrift, damaged, half flooded and abandoned. No passengers, no crew, no clear explanation as to what had occurred. The fate of the Joyita, a classic maritime mystery, grabbed international headlines at the time. But for Julie Parsons, it was not just a headline. It was a tragedy. Her Irish father, Dr. Alfred Dennis Parsons, known to family and friends as Andy, was one of the missing. His disappearance shaped everything that followed, including the family's decision to return to Ireland. In her new book, People Like Us, Parsons, the novelist, well-known novelist, begins with the Joyita, then widens the story. Through diaries, interviews, letters and archival research, she traces two intertwined Irish family lines, the Purefoys and the Chamberlains on her mother's side, the Parsons and the McClenahans on her father's, to explore themes of war, class, faith and belonging. Julie, you're very welcome to the History Show and welcome also to the world of non-fiction.
Thanks very much, Miles.
So the book opens with the disappearance of the MV Joyita. Why was your father on board that ship? And do we have any idea at all what happened to the crew and the passengers?
Well, the reason that he was on the boat was we had been living in New Zealand, but he had got a job in the hospital in Apia on the island of Samoa. So we'd gone to live there. And not long after we arrived, he was asked to go to the Tokelau Islands because there was a man who had a gangrenous arm that needed to be amputated. So my father, who in his time as a doctor in the Second World War was experienced at doing amputations, was quite happy to go off on the Joyita. There were 25 of them altogether, crew and passengers on it. So that's why he was going. And no, there is no clear explanation as to what happened. It's never been. The real mystery actually is why they abandoned the Joyita. It was reputed to be unsinkable. And although there was a leak and there was water coming into it, it wasn't a catastrophic leak. It wasn't a Titanic-like leak. It was a slow leak. And, you know, it's always recommended that you never abandon a ship, but they did. And unfortunately, they were never seen again.
And his medical instruments, I think, were found all over the ship, weren't they?
They were, yes. There were medical instruments. I think there were bandages, a few things like that. And there were sort of, you know, uneaten eggs in the galley. But really, there was very little, and there was absolutely the problem as well wasn't just the leak, but the radio wasn't working. So the boat actually, it never should have left Samoa, in fact. And Dusty Miller, who was the captain, was a kind of disreputable character, a kind of a South Sea Island sort of rogue and rascal, really. And he should never have been allowed to set sail or leave with that boat in the condition that it was in.
What was the, I mean, obviously you've done, you know, you're not going to remember, you were 4 years of age, you're not going to remember too much, if anything, but you've done a lot of research. So what was the speculation at the time as to what might have caused the abandonment of the ship or what might have caused this tragedy?
Well, there was kind of talk about sea spouts and sudden catastrophic waves, but the weather was actually very good at the time. And there was also a bit of speculation that it might have been, you know, Japanese soldiers who hadn't realised that the war was over.
And there were a few of them around.
There were, yes. Or it might have been pirates or whatever. But, you know, there was never any evidence of that. And I mean, my own feeling about it is that for whatever reason, they were completely spooked by being on the boat and they just decided they needed to get off it. So they didn't have lifeboats as such. They had what were called Carly floats, which are sort of 10 feet long rubber dinghies, not enough for all of them. But their view is that they launched these, tied them by rope to the stern of the Joyita, took turns getting in and out of them, although there was a woman with her two small children who I assume would have been in the Carly floats all the time. But there is a view that sometime during the night of the 4th of October, something happened. Possibly the rope broke, and when dawn rose, when dawn came, the Joyita was nowhere to be seen, and they were on their own. And after that, I'm afraid, there wasn't much that could be done for them.
And, I mean, it took a long time for your father to be declared dead. And to some extent, I mean, your mother wanted to come back to Ireland. You were stuck, really,
yes.
in New Zealand. You went back to New Zealand, I think, didn't you?
Yeah, we went back. We had a house in New Zealand, which was rented out. We went back to New Zealand. But because there was no body, he couldn't be declared dead immediately. She had to wait for 7 years. So when the 7 years were up, she went to court and had him declared legally dead, at which point the house could be sold because, of course, she couldn't sell the house because in the 1950s women didn't own houses, husbands owned houses. So we just stayed there, and she was a very resourceful woman, and she managed as best as she could. And we were in that kind of sort of limbo. I mean, she was always telling us stories about, you know, what Ireland was like. And she'd grown up in Dunleary. Her father was the clergyman of what had been the Mariners' Church. And so our childhood was sort of filled with romantic stories of Ireland and the family and the parish and how wonderful it was, swimming in the baths in the summer. And, you know, it was lovely. It was a wonderful picture she painted.
You were born in New Zealand. You obviously didn't come to Ireland until you were, what, 9 or 10?
12.
12 years of age, yeah. Your father, Andy, was from Athlone. Your mother, as you say, was Elizabeth Purefoy Chamberlain from Dublin, from Dunleary. Before the Gioia, though, there's another defining story in the book for both of them, for both your parents, and that's World War II. Each of them served in World War II.
That's right.
Can you tell us, first of all, about your father's activities?
Well, my father joined the Royal Army Medical Corps in 1940, not long after the war began. And the first place he was sent was northern France. And he wrote about it. He wrote the story kept the diary of his wartime experiences. And he was in northern France for only about 3 months. And it was completely chaotic because nobody knew what was happening. And he and his ambulance and his orderlies spent their whole time driving from small town to village, picking up dead and dying soldiers along the way, helping them as best as they could. Also, it has to be said now, having a bit of fun, because my father always somehow managed to have a bit of fun during these times. But then eventually the whole thing came to a sudden grinding halt, and they were told to go to Dunkirk, where he was evacuated.
And then he ended up in North Africa.
He did. So he stayed in England, and I think probably did a certain amount of sort of haphazard training. And then he was sent, first of all, to Syria, where he actually wound up in the famous town of Palmyra, the one that we heard a lot about that ISIS took over. And he writes actually about the most amazing thing about Palmyra was that there was this wonderful swimming pool that had been built by defaulters from the French Foreign Legion, and Australian sappers had built a diving stage, and he described how you could lie up on the top of the diving stage and look around at all these wonderful Greek and Roman statues and things like that. But after that, then, he eventually wound up in Libya, where he was part of the force whose job it was to push Rommel and the Africa Corps back, keep them away from Alexandria, keep them away from Cairo, push them back, and eventually to destroy them, which is actually what the British Army did.
Now, he faced a lot of danger because he was basically following armoured units, and he wasn't armoured. He was driving a vehicle that was very much not armoured.
He wasn't at all. And he was, you might say, kind of scooting around behind the soldiers and basically dealing the casualties as he came upon them. And, I mean, these were men who had really horrific injuries, multiple compound fractures, blast wounds, bodies that were basically torn open. I mean, he did a lot of amputating. There's one story, actually, in North Africa where he amputated a man's foot with a penknife. Now, I think in North Africa, it was a bit more organized than that. But certainly, I mean, he was picking up men. He was putting them in the ambulance. He was trying to give them, first of all, they were always given morphine immediately. But it was pretty horrific, actually. And as he said in a letter that he wrote to his sister, all abdominal wounds will die, because they didn't have antibiotics or anything like that. And by the time he got them from the battlefield back to what was called the casualty clearing station, which was basically the hospital, they would be long gone.
Many years ago, you allowed me to have a look at his memoir, and it's called Exit at Anzio, For a very good reason. That was the end of his war, wasn't it?
It was, unfortunately. He went through the Battle of El Alamein, and he was awarded the Military Cross for gallantry at that time, where he spent, there was one evening, one night apparently, when he went around picking up wounded New Zealand soldiers and when he was under fire. But anyway, at the end of that, I think they had hoped they'd be sent back to Britain, but they weren't. They were sent to Italy, where again the British Army was intent on pushing the German army back up through Italy, getting them out of, as far away from, you know, as containing them and destroying them. And he wound up in Anzio, which is a small seaside town about an hour and a half outside Rome. Very, very dangerous place. They were basically camped in a swamp, and all around them was the German army, and above them was the German Air Force. They were constantly under fire. And unfortunately, one day he went out and he was picking up a soldier off the ground, and boom, a shell landed right beside him and tore his right thigh open and severed his sciatic nerve. And unfortunately, that was the end of his wartime experience.
But also he was in pain for the rest of his life.
He was. He was sent back to hospital in Oxford, and they tried a number of almost kind of experimental operations to try and rejoin his sciatic nerve, but that never worked. And he was in pain for the rest of his life, and it had a very devastating effect on him.
Now, your mother, Elizabeth, was also in the British forces during the Second World War. First of all, she was a nurse. Then she was a member of the Women's Royal Naval Service, the Wrens. And in fact, we have a clip recorded in the early 1990s in an amazing series called Distant Drums. The reason I call it amazing is because I actually compiled it, but that's just me. This is Elizabeth, Lizzie, as she was known, describing her experiences after joining the Wrens in 1942.
And then we spent our whole time for about a fortnight learning about naval routine, and we talked about our cabins, and the forecastle was the sitting room. We scrubbed the heads. We marched miles. It was very, very hard work, but it was great, and met lots of people. And eventually I passed out as a trainee bomb range marker, which was in the Fleet Air Arm. When the planes were practicing bombing targets, we had to take readings of whether they used to drop a stick of bombs, three bombs, and we had to take readings of where the bombs went, and the middle bomb was supposed to hit the target.
And that was the voice of Elizabeth Parsons, an irrepressible woman. She was quite something. Tell us more about her life during the war, her first marriage, and then how she met Andy Parsons, because the first marriage didn't last very long.
No, unfortunately, it didn't. She went over, I think it's very interesting, really, how she and all her friends, my father and all his friends, as soon as war was declared, their intention was to join up, and they all joined up.
And they're all Irish.
They were all Irish, yes, they were all Irish. Most of them were Church of Ireland or Protestant. I think they had some feeling that this was a really terrible thing that was happening, and they wanted to be part of it. So she couldn't join the Wrens directly from Ireland, so she went over as a nurse's aide in a hospital called Botley's, which was pretty tough, actually. It was quite a tough kind of thing to do. And then in December 1942, she actually got into the Wrens, and she was really delighted. So she was stationed in various places around Britain in a place called Macrahanish in Scotland, which she didn't like at all because it was cold and miserable and you know, not great. And then she met a man called Michael Beresford Jones, who was a pilot in the Fleet Air Arm, which is a kind of a part of the Navy. He fell for her big time, and I think she fell for him, although I'm not 100% certain. Anyway, he decided that they should get married, and so they did. And then he was also stationed in Macrahanish, and he was out doing practicing bombing runs one day, and his plane came out of a cloud and went straight into the lake, and he was killed, and his body was never found. So that was only, they were only married for six weeks. Mm. So it was pretty shocking, really. She was very interesting about it. She said how sad it was that she didn't really know him at all, you know. And after...
That would not have been unusual during the war, would it?
No, not at all. Mm. No, no. But she said it was terribly sad because when all his belongings were sent to her and when she opened up his trunk, she discovered that he was mad about poetry. The trunk was filled with books of poetry and that he wrote poetry too. And she didn't know anything about this. Mm. But in those days, I mean, that was what it was like, you know. you met someone, you fell in love, you got married, and then who knows what would happen after that.
Mm. And how did she meet Andy?
Well, she'd met Andy before this. When he came home on leave, after he was in evacuated from Dunkirk, he was sent home, and she was invited to go to a dance in the Gresham. They needed another girl for Andy. So she met him there, and I don't think they got on particularly well to begin with. He wasn't mad about dancing, and she was mad about dancing. But anyway, they survived that first evening together, and then he went back to England. They kept in touch, and then before he was sent off to North Africa, he came back on what was called embarkation leave, and they met again. And that was, you know, it was obvious that they were mad about each other, but he was 9 years older than she was. He was going back to war, and he said, look, really, you know, we can't make any commitments because who knows what'll happen. But then when he was wounded and he came back to hospital in Oxford, she heard that he was ill and she went to visit him. And apparently there was a week when she spent every minute of every day with him. And at the end of it, they were engaged.
Mm. Didn't have that long to spend with him either.
No, she didn't.
Considerably
no.
More
no,
than the first marriage. Okay, so then you also, in the book, you trace the generations, the earlier generations, the Purefoys and the Chamberlains on one side. But talk to me about your father's antecedents, because there's an interesting story there. The book connects your family history to the events of the early 1920s during the War of Independence and the Civil War. And his family experience was an interesting one, not necessarily a positive one.
Yes. So my father's family, the Parsons, they had shoe shops in the Midlands, two in Athlone and one in Moat, Ballinasloe and Mullingar. They were a very well-known family in Athlone. You know, Parsons was an established shop and everybody bought their shoes in Parsons. And he was a member of the golf club, a member of the yacht club. You know, he was a respected member of the kind of the what you might call the retail community. And he married a girl called Grace McLenahan. And Grace's family were also very well known. Her father was Canon George McLenahan, who was rector of St. Peter's Church in Athlone, which was the biggest of the, there were two, St. Peter's and St. Mary's. So they got married in 1904, and there's a wonderful photograph in the book of their wedding, which was huge, and all the kind of Athlones, the great and the good of Athlone, all lined up, all, you know, celebrating this wonderful day. And so what was very interesting was they moved to Greystones in 1920, and there was never any explanation for why they moved. And my mother kind of sort of said, oh, well, you know, they wanted to live somewhere that was a bit kind of posher than Athlone, although it seems to me that the Athlone they lived in was posh enough. But then when I started looking at it, I sort of looked at the date. I thought, yeah, 1920, I wonder what was going on there. And of course, what it was that this was the aftermath of 1916, and there was quite a lot of activity, you might say, in Athlone. As far as the shops were concerned, there was this thing called the Belfast boycott, where basically people were discouraged from shopping in shops which carried goods that came from Belfast or anywhere associated with Britain. And also, Grace's father, he was the chaplain to the British Army in Victoria Barracks, which was across the road from where she lived. And I kind of feel that what happened was they began to think, hold on a minute, what's going to happen here? Mm. And sure enough, there were attacks against the shops. The shop in Ballinasloe, a bomb went off outside it and gunshots were fired at it. And I think they just thought, hang on a minute, maybe this isn't going to be such a great place to live. So, in fact, it's interesting really because if you look at the 1911 census, if you compare Athlone and Greystones, Greystones has considerably more houses that make returns that are Protestant than Athlone. So I kind of think maybe they just thought, hang on a minute, you know. But I think it's very sad, really, because particularly for Grace, because her parents and two of her sisters were buried in the local cemetery in Athlone. And I kind of think it's sad to think that she left that part of herself behind, you know. Mm. But anyway, they made the move and they kept the shops. And George Parsons, my grandfather, would go down to Athlone once a week and kind of take care of business. But I think it's kind of sad to think of them leaving that big part of their heritage behind.
And then on the other side, your mother's side, the Purefoys and the Chamberlains, all Dublin, South Dublin, suburbs of Dublin? Is that the case?
Not originally, but of course this was something that I only discovered. My mother, it's funny really, because you know the name Purefoy. My mother used to say, oh yes, you know the Purefoys were Huguenots, you know, French name and all that kind of stuff. And I'd say, oh yes.
There's a Purefoy in Ulysses at some
Yes,
point.
There is actually. Mm. I think because my great-great-uncle was Dr. Richard Dancer Purefoy, who was the master of the Rotunda Hospital. And I always reckon that Joyce stole the name, you know, because he has the character Mina Purefoy, who's in labour. But anyway, that's a bit of a... Anyway, Purefoys, Huguenots, we all know about the Huguenots, oppressed people, chucked out of France, etc., etc. But when I started actually looking at the Purefoys, it was suggested to me by one of my mother's cousins that if I really wanted to know who the Purefoys were, I should speak to a distant cousin called Roger Grant, who lived in Southend-on-Sea. So when I did, Roger revealed to me the, to me, shattering story that actually the Purefoys weren't Huguenots, the Purefoys were Cromwellians,
Ooh.
That they came here, that in fact we have a relation called William Purefoy, who was an intimate, you might say, of Oliver Cromwell. In fact, he was also a regicide. He was one of the people who signed Charles I's death warrant. And he had a cousin called Gamaliel Purefoy, who had four sons who were all in Cromwell's army, who all came here, and that we, the current Purefoys, are descended from one Arthur Purefoy. So I was pretty horrified when I heard this. Wasn't really sure what to do with this piece of information. If I could have undiscovered it, I think I probably would. The Huguenot story was much better, but of course I can't. So that's the reality.
And Lizzie's father then was
yes.
the director of the Mariners' Church.
That's right.
So it was, and it did cater to mariners at one stage.
It did. It was built in about 1850, and it was built specifically for the sailors in the Royal Navy, because of course it was in Dunleary, or Kingstown as they called it, and that's where they were based, but also the men who worked on the mail boat, and also fishermen, you know, visiting mariners or visiting fishermen who would arrive in Dunleary, Kingstown, and if it was a Sunday, they'd all go to the church. So that was where it got its name from.
Mm. And, I mean, what kind of an experience do you think he would have been your grandfather would
yes.
have had in Dunleary? I mean, would he have been well known in the area?
Oh, he was very, very well known. Mm. I mean, there's a photograph on the cover of the book which shows him walking the East Pier, which is what he did every day. He was a well-known sight, you know, Canon Chamberlain with his black hat and his black suit and his stick and his pocket watch. And as he walked down, he'd be greeting everybody and everybody would be greeting him. He was very, very well known. And in fact, it was a very nice parish, you know. It was very well known. Everybody knew the church, of course, which is a huge church, and it's now the Maritime Museum, and the rectory in Adelaide Street, which was where the Chamberlain family, my mother and her sister and brother, lived.
Well, it's a fascinating family story, Julie, going back a number of generations on both sides. The book is called People Like Us. The author is my guest, Julie Parsons. You can get hold of a copy of the book at julieparsons.ie. Julie, many thanks for joining us on The History Show this evening.
Thank you.